This is an IEEE Computer Society podcast. I'm David Alan Greer, and this is The Known World. I think most of you who are listening know that these podcasts and the column that form their basis are my attempt to come to grips with the world of computation, with that world in which we live that interacts with governments and schools and institutions and businesses, all in one grand web. Many of them of late have been based on stories of students or colleagues or businesses that I have been working with. This one started with an incident that happened to me, to my infrastructure that supports me. It attempts to come to grips with how we deal with sudden and unexpected changes in our infrastructure. And it's called The Voice of Wisdom. We had a minor crisis this week. The chief technology officer notified us that some piece of IT software, not well known to most of us, had expired after a short illness. Interment happened quickly. There was no ceremony. This event, however, had immediate ramifications. Changes would have to be made, he explained, and the servers would be switched with barely 48 hours' notice. This work would not only return email to operation, but allegedly it would create a stronger system in the name of good engineering. The news of the switch stirred the anxieties of my coworkers and provoked angry reactions. During the 2 days prior to the change, they did nothing but complain. They could engage in little else. Unable to do anything to support the fix to the old system or to advance the new, they were reduced to claiming that they were doing work of such great national importance that interrupting it, even for a moment, might engender a global crisis. Such crises illuminate the nature of technical commodities. The first time we switched email servers almost 18 years ago, most of the system's active users watched the transition with a kind of curiosity, the kind of curiosity usually reserved for observing the neighborhood mechanic who is repairing a car in the driveway. The second switch, only the more technically inclined, followed the deployment of the new hardware and software. We sat around on the side and offered advice about the system's design and suggested an approach to the configuration that might make the work easier. This last time, none of us participated in the technical work. We have no real contact with our computer center anymore. It has moved to some rural village in Iowa, I think, or maybe it's in Kazakhstan. And we only hear from the staff in anonymous mass emails that are about as welcoming as the lease agreements for downloaded software. They don't want our ideas. They only wanted to know how we used email so that they could divide us into three waves and make the transition go smoothly. The sophisticated users would be the first group to test the landing zone for mines and booby traps. The large mass mailers would go second to ensure that the new system had a stable infrastructure. Last would be the teeming and unwashed masses, anxious about losing their service even for a day and ready to voice those fears for all. This is how we adopt new technology in the information age. As we pass through each cycle of transition, we find that our technical opinions lose importance while our consumer behavior moves towards the center of the process. On several occasions in recent months, I've realized that I've been watching a new form of transition as more and more friends begin using cloud computing services. Unlike the first users of email or the World Wide Web, these individuals know little about the underlying technology and demonstrate almost no interest in learning more. Even the briefest discussion of the three basic divisions of cloud computing, software as a service, infrastructure as a service, or platform as a service, gets dismissed with an impatient wave of the hand. They're behaving as sophisticated consumers, not as technologists. And they're looking for computing services that meet their consumer needs. Many friends have told me that they became interested in cloud computing when they saw an advertisement on some sporting event that they were watching on television. Most of us know that such a venue is unlikely to teach us much about technology of anything, whether the product is computing services, automobiles, or beer. Furthermore, we need to remember that these commercials are written to instill the values of being a good consumer, of accepting the wisdom that we should trust others to guide our actions. Except for the most shrill and aggressive advertisements, television commercials often take the form of a parable or wisdom story. The first section describes a problem that is caused by the lack of wisdom. The second offers moral instruction and asks us to trust the providers of this instruction. The final part offers a vision of heaven, the reward for trusting the instruction. In the modern commercial, I should add, this vision often looks exactly like a certain expensive beach resort or a famous theme park that has a particular appeal to young children. In the cloud computing advertisement, which I saw not that long ago, the first part of the story presents the problem of a mother, anxious and stressed. This woman knows not how to balance the competing demands of work and family. Hence, she is faced with undisciplined children, demanding parents, an impatient husband, a messy house, one of the worst sins that can exist, and unappetizing food that she serves for supper because she lacks the time to prepare a balanced meal. In the wisdom section of this parable, a neighbor visits the mother, bringing the good news of the cloud and encouraging her to trust this technology with her needs. And within moments, the two of them have created a schedule for the family, fixed the household budget, uploaded photographs, and prepared a meal that will soothe the husband's wounded soul. The final moments of the advertisement show the happy family visiting the aforementioned theme park in Florida. All are delighted with the benefits of new cloud technology. After seeing this advertisement, no one has asked me about the nature of cloud computing or cloud services. Following the arc of the ad, they immediately raise the central question of consumer behavior. Can we trust the wisdom of the cloud? Can we trust the cloud with the most intimate details of our lives? Does this mean, they ask, that the cloud will store all of our correspondence out there in Silicon Valley? My friends are never satisfied with my answers, which are admittedly a little provocative. I first note that the cloud service is technically in Oregon, not in Silicon Valley, and then point out that they've been freely offering information about their behavior to the great servers of cyberspace. The cloud may consolidate this information, but it's only one more step in a process that's now 15 years old at least. In fact, I tell them where we've reached the point where the lack of an internet footprint is evidence of suspicious behavior. Well, like everything, I have a story that explains this point. Last summer, my sister-in-law received an email from someone who claimed to be interested in purchasing a machine that she had advertised for sale. Something about this email seemed a little odd. So I did some probing to see if I could learn something about the sender. After about 15 minutes, I had found nothing on the internet beyond the evidence, albeit somewhat circumstantial, that the email account had only been active for a couple of days. When she saw what I had found, my sister-in-law dismissed it by saying, "That doesn't prove anything." "Perhaps," I said. "But watch this." I typed her email address into a common search engine and received roughly 50,000 replies. If you have no record on the internet, you're not only hiding your information, you're hiding your behavior. We've found it convenient to claim that our private behavior has fallen victim to the various forms of computing technology. However, older forms of technology have demanded payments from our stock of privacy as they moved through the transition that turned them into commodities. While we sometimes express regret that we've lost a vital part of our private lives to the information-collecting power of technology, we must remember that few of us resisted this change. Instead, we suggested the suggestion that we trust the wisdom of this technology, and then we rushed to the discount store to see what kind of a deal we could get. 20 years before we had digital computers, radio, the technology of radio, was demanding information about its listeners' tastes and ideals and actions. Perhaps the most dramatic example of radio's ability to gather information came on the Great Plains of the United States. The scale of farming in this region separated families and posed a natural privacy. In some states, such as the Dakotas, Nebraska, Kansas, Wyoming, farms might be separated by 2 or 3 miles of road that were difficult to travel at night and impossible to navigate in bad weather. In this environment, radio promised to be a way of getting information to farm families and to pulling those families into a giant community. "It's now quite universally accepted," wrote the radio engineer Cyril Jansky in 1928, "that radio broadcasting can fundamentally be of greater economic and social service to rural communities than to cities." Initially, Jansky viewed the development of radio solely as a technical problem. He spent almost 10 years traveling the Great Plains to map the strength of radio signals. However, as he developed his map, Jansky began to realize that the radio infrastructure had a human dimension that signal strength alone could not explain. "It is evident," he concluded, "that no apparent relationship exists between the number of radios in the various counties and the availability of service on the basis of daylight field intensity standards. Families," he was saying, "place so much value on radio broadcasts that they gladly accepted mediocre service and would strain their ears to catch every program." Jansky gathered his information about radio users by knocking on doors and asking questions of farming families. It was an age before sample surveys, Likert scores, and the accoutrements of market research. Individual radio stations began to gather their own information about their listeners by asking them to send postcards, holding public events, and creating contests that revealed how families acted and the programs they wanted to hear. In 1935, Jansky wrote that radio had become a regular service in the area, though not through any specific outstanding achievement, either in the design of transmission and reception equipment, but because there has become a more general recognition of engineering fundamentals resulting in certain trends in the art, which may be expected to bring about more efficient use of the scientific knowledge, which forms the basis for the entire industry. In using the term engineering fundamentals, Jansky was referring to the technology of transmission, but others used the same term to describe the work of collecting information. One engineer who was determined to create an engineered science of consumer information was Arthur Charles Nielsen. Trained in electrical engineering, Nielsen developed systematic processes for collecting information for radio stations that used the post office and other communications technology of his time. In 1938, he began collecting information with an automatic machine that he called the Autometer. The device, he explained in a New York Times article, is a square box attached to a radio set and recording through a perforated tape the periods when the radio set is in use and when it is turned off. The work of Jansky and Nielsen changed society, though in profoundly different ways. Jansky established a series of techniques for measuring signal strength. His brother, Carl Jansky, a Bell Labs engineer, used similar techniques to establish the fact that the Earth was not an isolated body and that it was constantly receiving signals from extraterrestrial sources. It is hard to believe that from the Hercules cluster, explained a writer who was familiar with Carl Jansky's research, comes this cosmic hissing. The idea that we might have cosmic neighbors who were sending us radio signals was slightly unsettling. It helped contribute to the panic that followed the 1938 Halloween radio drama War of the Worlds. While many commentators have liked to make sport of that panic and show how naive all the listeners were, they overlook, in general, the observation that by that time, commercial radio was only slightly more than a decade old, younger than the internet is today, but that it had already created a unified community for listeners. Families across the country not only heard of landing Martians on that Halloween night, but they also heard the shows that they soon identified with the golden age of radio. George Byrne and Gracie Allen, Toscanini and the NBC Orchestra, the Mutual Broadcast Network, and the Lone Ranger and the thrilling days of yesteryear. In that period, advertisers freely applied the word radio to products that had nothing to do with broadcast technology. Radio Keith Orpheum Pictures, Radio City Music Hall, Radio Flyer Toy Wagons. During this period, the general public still had some interest in radio technology and would discuss issues such as antenna placement or the specification of the best receivers. However, this interest soon faded as radio became a commercial commodity. It seems plausible that our age will be labeled as the golden age of the internet, the time when new applications appeared almost monthly and the cloud was beginning to replace the rough technology of networks. Again, we have only a vague notion about the results of such a transition. However, unlike the golden age of radio, we have a sense that the coming growth of cloud services will somehow involve large amounts of data that describe how we act, how we think, and how we move. The cloud may indeed make our lives simpler. It may bring us new ideas and even introduce us to new friends. We already have companies promising that this technology will make us wise and urging us to take their advice. You have been listening to The Known World. This podcast was based on an essay which was published in the March 2010 issue of Computer, which is a publication of the Computer Society. More about both Computer the magazine and Computer the Society can be found at www.computer.org. More about this podcast can be found at www.computer.org/theknownworld. And that last bit is all one word. You can find other Computer Society podcasts at www.computer.org/podcasts. And if you have any comments, we'd love to hear them. You can send them to podcasts@computer.org. The music for this podcast came from the Music Alley PodSafe Network, which you can find at musicalley.com. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.